You are listening to A Good Book on Sun Sounds of Arizona.
Kirin's The Spell of Noan, written and narrated by James D. Priest.
Chapter 36. The alarmed Deliani knew she had no time to waste. Presuming Speckren was asleep, she didn't disturb him. She took the stairway and climbed down the wall as fast as she could. If Farallon somehow gets out into the woods, she thought, I'll need a bird to catch him. Reaching the cave's floor, she ran to the tunnel housing the ravens and was surprised that only two were there, hers and Speckren's. Hutz Lisam was gone also. Quickly astride a puzzled Manet, she asked for speed, and the great bird stalked into the open. She asked for flight, and the raven lifted off hesitantly in the cave's enclosed space and flew only briefly, a few strokes of the wings, before arriving at the arched entrance. The flight was a feat nonetheless. Shillitoes would have been interested in seeing, because to them a Kirin in flight was a rare sight. But it was early, and no one was there to witness it. Dismounting, Deliani encouraged Manet to enter with her, but the raven balked. It took many curlace phrases and reassuring caresses before her ruffled feathers were calmed, and she finally followed her mistress into the dark tunnel. Deliani tried to hurry, but they could go no faster than they had yesterday. She wondered why Farallon and apparently Lisam left the cave, especially through this tunnel, which the ravens despised. She remembered that yesterday Runagar had come through a larger passageway that would accommodate foxes. But, anxious to catch the other ravens in this one, she kept going. Moving haltingly through the dark, she half expected to collide with them or hear their low groans of displeasure, but her progress was unimpeded. Finally, she saw a tall, slim shaft of light. They were at the end of the tunnel, entering a larger space, the light coming through a thin crack between the two giant doors. "Where are Farallon and Lisam?" she wondered aloud. She approached one of the massive structures and pushed. It didn't move. In her haste and concern for Farallon, she hadn't thought about opening the doors. "This can't be difficult," she told herself. "Shillitoes pass through here all the time." She called out to anyone nearby, a sentry regulating the doors, or anybody else. "I am searching for two ravens who must have been just ahead of me. My business is urgent." No answer came. Striding intently back and forth at the base of the dusky walls, she felt for a device which might control the doors, a lever, a wheel, any kind of fixture. Searching both sides of the space, high and low, she found nothing but cold, bare stone. "How could the other ravens have gotten out? We certainly didn't pass them along the way. Perhaps they weren't alone, but with someone who could operate the doors. Who? Why would they take the ravens?" "How do these things open?" she said aloud. "They must work from here," she thought, exasperated, calling out again and searching the walls again, but to no avail. She pushed and pulled on the doors as hard as her strength allowed, but the massive structures didn't budge. She leaned back against one to rest, convinced someone had escorted the two Ilan outside. They would never have entered the corridor alone, and someone had to operate the doors. Had I glanced from the terrace toward the cave's floor moments earlier, I might have seen who. "We have little knowledge of these Shillitoes," she thought. The evening before, while Speckren was busy with Lydor, she had talked with an attendant in the Farinen. He mentioned that Shillitoes don't use Bird Ilan because of the dangers involved, epitomized by what happened to Tali. Another tribe living nearby, he said, employed Bird Ilan, Deliani wondering what species. Could Shillitoes have borrowed the ravens, she wondered now, to show them to the other tribe? I doubt it. Could members of that tribe have abducted them? Why? None of it matters now. Farallon and Lisam are missing, and I'm doing nothing to find them. Aggravated, she stepped away from the giant doors, glancing at them over her shoulder, and started toward the cave. "I'll alert Speckerin and get help to open these monsters." "You won't like it," she told Manet, "but we're going back. We'll soon return to find your companions." A bewildered Manet followed her into the tunnel, and what little light filtered through the slit was soon gone. Deliani worried as she proceeded that when Tali awoke, she might not have an Eilon. Onward they moved, Deliani in the lead, threading her way along the dark passageway, its course undulating as she remembered, and she encouraged her beloved raven, knowing this to be painful and frightening for her. Recalling Issar's shrill voice beseeching them to follow, Deliani smiled, remembering Speckerin's remark, after they bumped their heads, that they had found where the tunnel narrows. Stretching her arms above her head, she was surprised to find no ceiling. "We haven't quite gotten there," she said. "We're moving more cautiously than I thought. Let's try to go faster." She did, and the bird followed faithfully. The tunnel changed its course, and they were soon scraping against walls and ceiling. "This is where it narrows," she said. "We're almost there. But we'll have only a brief rest, my friend, because we'll return for the other Eilon, as we would for you if you were missing." She began looking ahead for light, the circle of brightness she had seen yesterday. It didn't appear, and she persisted, feeling her way along the rocky walls. When she was certain light from the cave was around the corner, to her surprise the tunnel widened. Again she couldn't touch the ceiling. Not recalling this expansion at all, she thought of a reason. "Speckerin and I were exhausted yesterday. I must not remember all aspects of the tunnel." On they went, Deliani more puzzled by the moment. "Where's the cave?" she wondered, straining with every step to see a welcoming glow ahead. Starting down a mild incline, first one foot and then the other became damp, and when she stepped again, it caused a splash. She stopped. "This water wasn't here yesterday," she thought, then had a sickening feeling. "Nor was it when we passed through here a short while ago. Could it have seeped from an underground source? Perhaps one feeding the stream in the cave? It can't have been here very long. Perhaps we can cross it." She told Manet to wait and moved forward cautiously, holding up her gown and placing one foot in front of the other. The farther she went, the deeper it got. When it was up to her knees, she stopped, turned around, and climbed out. "Something's happened," she said to Manet. "This was not here before. I don't like it. We might run into something unpredictable." Placing a hand on the bird's neck, she helped her turn around, then stopped, wondering whether it was water. Reaching down, she scooped some up in her hand and raised it to her nose. It had no odor and dripped from her palm like water. "What do we do now? We have two choices: wait for someone to come or retrace our steps to the door." Waiting would be unpleasant and, if this is a seldom used tunnel, might be long. Sooner or later, traffic will pass through the entrance, and at least some light is there. "We're going back to the doors," she told Manet, and started in that direction. They progressed for a considerable time, the corridor bending left, right, upward, and down. Having become keenly aware of the features of the walls and floor, the only clues she had to their whereabouts, Deliani didn't recognize any as they went. She strained to see the slit of light she knew to be ahead, just ahead, she hoped. Nothing appeared, and they labored on, having little alternative. A disturbing thought struck her. "Other tunnels connect with the one we passed through yesterday and took this morning. Runagar chose one for the foxes. Could we have made a wrong turn?" With no way of knowing, she tried not to think about anything but moving ahead, encouraging Manet and herself with words of promise and success. At intervals, she would stop, quiet Manet, and call out, "Can anyone hear me? I am a visitor and have a bird Eilon with me. I am not certain where we are. Then, listening intently for a reply, she never received one. Both she and the bird were beginning to tire from physical effort, avoiding collision with rough surfaces, and mental stress. Though frustration and concern were driving her, she knew they needed a rest. They halted, and she wondered where they might have gone wrong. Could there be a series of interconnected passageways? Stopping will get us nowhere, she thought, and they resumed their progress, edging along, finding only perpetual blackness and unending tunnel. Again they rested, this time longer, then moved ahead. As they became more exhausted, a pattern developed. The periods for recuperation became longer, those of exploration shorter. Having no idea how much time had elapsed, Deliani called for another rest, standing with her back against the wall, then sliding heavily down until seated on the floor, her spine against cold stone. She shivered as a deep, unwelcome worry filled her mind, one she had fought to keep away, but now allowed herself to recognize. She had no idea where they were. They were lost. Harsh sounds of distress came from the raven's throat. Reaching out to touch the bird, already lying on the floor, Deliani spoke reassuringly. We'll rest, renew our energy, then reach our goal. The bird attempted to lift her head and turn toward her mistress, but gave up, unable to see a thing, and laid her head back on the floor. Sounds from the bird gradually subsided as Deliani sat in the gloom, convinced that when they resumed their search, they would find the doors or the cave. We must. They're there. Soon the only sound coming from the raven was quiet, rhythmic breathing. Even that diminished as she instinctively calmed herself to preserve energy for the next foray into darkness. Deliani thought back to childhood, to methods taught in training if one should become lost or disoriented. Especially you children, she could hear her old instructor saying, stay where you are when you recognize you are lost and protect yourself. The clan will soon realize you are missing and come to find you. Getting farther afield will make matters worse. That's the way it is in the forest, near the clan trees, she thought, a pang in her stomach. Perhaps that's the way it is here, too, and I'd make a mistake by continuing on. They probably don't know we're missing yet. Speckrin was asleep. During our hasty departure, nobody was around. When they discover we're missing, I hope they'll have some idea where to look. Perhaps other visitors have been lost in these tunnels. Not dwelling on this, she began searching her memory, trying to retrace their steps, both from the cave to the doors and from the doors in the opposite direction. Becoming drowsy, she didn't fight it. It was a welcome escape, and soon she fell into a fitful sleep. Before long, something alarming filtered into her dreams, the presence of someone or something. Abruptly awakening, she heard an unmistakable sound, one Manet never made, and felt warm breath on her neck. Something was sniffing her. Chapter 37. John Versteeg eyed Jilin, who stood near the end of the workbench, and peered at the space he was pointing to, but could see nothing. "I'd like to meet your companion," said the old man, cleansing the injured wing. But confused enough by the whole affair, he turned away from the introduction as though it hadn't happened and went on with his work. "If you're not certain how to handle Luana's injuries," said Jilin, clutching the calamar, "Rugum Chamter is and can help." "Who's Rugum Chamter?" asked Nathan, he and his brother observing wide-eyed. "Is Luana the bird?" asked Christopher. Jilin turned to the boys. Rugam Chamter is an overseer of our clan, the Yorl clan. We live in a great tree far to the west. Loana's the injured bird. John Versteeg was flabbergasted that he could be associating with a being as minuscule and alien as this, but he was doing so anyway. I could use his help. Why doesn't he show himself? He's standing beside me, said Jilin, who then revealed something that astounded the gentleman and delighted the boys. But he's invisible. Except under rare circumstances, we've been invisible for thousands of years and have remained unknown to humans. For reasons too complicated to explain, I am a rare exception. Rugam was growing uncomfortable at being so near the humans, yet he wanted to communicate with them about Loana. He was repulsed by them, his English was rusty, and he was invisible. Nonetheless, he decided to take charge.
You do right work, he blurted.
Had he spoken the home dialect, the Calamar would have translated it into perfect English. But with him speaking English, no matter how broken, no translation occurred. Hearing a second voice from the vicinity of the first, John Versteeg stared and saw only Jilin.
The old human heard me, thought Rugam, and he went on. Wash much as can.
He took a few steps toward the basin to get a closer look, Jilin following.
I'm about to change the water, said the man, lifting Loana out of the basin and setting her on the workbench.
Need clean water to rinse out the soap.
He emptied the soapy water into a sink, filled the basin with fresh water, put it back on the bench, and gently lowered Loana into it. As care of the bird proceeded, ideas and information were exchanged between the old Kirin and the old man, the Calamar translating when necessary, all to the boy's amazement and pleasure.
I wish Pat and Mike could see this, whispered Nathan to his brother. They wouldn't believe their eyes.
Christopher knew this was coming. He pulled Nathan into the hallway.
Don't you tell them, he whispered harshly. Don't tell anyone. Don't interfere with these little people. Let them do what they want. If anyone finds out they're here, they'll want to come and see them. Keep your mouth shut.
Nathan sidled back into the workroom. Christopher stayed in the hall with a lot on his mind. He knew his brother well and hoped to buy time for the little creatures before an onslaught, a circus, a madhouse was created by his brother. Nathan had never respected living things the way he did. Nathan would go out of his way to step on an insect. Christopher tried not to harm living things, large or small. He and Nathan were just different. But Christopher could see what was going to happen with this little being and perhaps its invisible companion. For the past few weeks, he had been in a quandary. For a long time, he had wanted to shoot, but not necessarily kill, which was part and parcel of hunting. He had seen his grandpa and others bring down ducks and other wild game and enjoyed eating them, but he hadn't shot them and wasn't sure how he felt about doing so. Several years ago, he had asked his grandfather the reasons for killing game and still remembered the answer. Listen carefully. We all must eat. For many thousands of years, our ancestors, with skills and weapons, killed wild creatures to obtain food. People still do. But in our culture, meat is available, sometimes the same meat that can be gotten by hunting, in supermarkets. Where does that meat come from? By sacrificing animals in slaughterhouses. Which is more noble and which more degrading, that or hunting? I don't pretend to know, but I'm not ashamed to hunt and fish if what I kill is consumed as nourishment. Needless killing is not warranted and should never be condoned. Christopher had not understood all the words, but the meaning was clear. Pondering the matter years later, he still didn't know the answer. His grandfather would teach him to shoot, but Christopher was unsure whether he was suited to be a hunter. Nathan had no such qualms, shooting the raven on a whim. Christopher's instinct was to protect the Kirins, but he knew Nathan couldn't keep them a secret. Their grandfather was dazed by the whole affair, and it might be up to Christopher to protect them. They were intelligent and had a mission, and he'd help them in any way he could. He went back into the workroom. The process of cleansing the bird's wounds was coming to an end. Rugham asked Jilin not to translate for a while.
"I want to discuss this with you first," said the overseer.
The lad slipped the calamar into his satchel. The elder described the next steps, dressing and splinting the wing, becoming agitated as he did.
"In treating open wounds, we apply a saturated cloth over them. The liquid is prepared from shavings of the leaves and stem of tamanietto, an herb with potent medicinal qualities. It reduces inflammation and repels unwanted organisms, preventing infection."
"Where do we find tamanietto?"
"Yet we have no time to waste, for the hostile behavior of a wound like this begins immediately. Secondly, at home we use cords made from the callus plant to bind the wing to the body. Injuries as severe as these will take a long time to heal, and the splints must remain in place. Therefore, we cover the cords with pitch from an evergreen tree, making them adhere and not slide off the feathered surface. Do humans have any such cords or callus? Why would they?"
Taking out the calamar, Jilin spoke to the elderly human who was awaiting his next orders. "The materials normally used next are not available here." He described callus and tamanietto. The old gentleman was gradually feeling less disturbed about communicating with the tiny beings. The situation was real, and their problems had to be dealt with.
"We have something that might do the same job as your callus," he said. "It's sticky on one side."
He turned to the boys.
"Run and get the first aid kit from the kitchen, in one of the lower cupboards by the sink."
"I know where," said Nathan.
He ran down the hall and up the stairs. He returned with the case kept for emergencies and handed it to his grandfather. He opened it and took out a round tin. Opening it, he found the end of a white tape, pulled a short strip from the reel, and tore it off. Putting his hands down near Jilin, he demonstrated the adherence of one side, then the strength of the material by stretching it tautly.
"We call it adhesive tape."
Jilin looked at Rugham, who was gazing at the strip intently.
"I've never seen anything like it," he said quietly, "but it appears that it might work."
The old man fumbled through other objects in the box and came up with a small metallic tube. He examined the label, then unscrewed the plastic cap.
"This is an antibiotic ointment for fighting infection. It's a bit old, but the expiration date hasn't passed. It works well on humans with open sores or cuts, and might take the place of your herb."
The old gentleman searched through the case again and brought out packaged dressings. He tore the wrapper off one and showed the gauze pad to his tiny advisors.
"We could apply the ointment to this and cover the wounds."
Rugham spoke to Jilin.
"These things will have to do."
Then he addressed the human.
"We must now immobilize the wing. The outer break must be splinted with struts, one on the wing's upper surface, the other on the lower. They will be held in place by the white strips. Do you have such struts?"
John Versteeg glanced about the workshop, his eyes falling on a pile of wooden scraps intended for kindling in the fireplace. He pointed them out, then picked up several and placed them on the workbench. Walking up to them, Rugham chose two lightweight, smooth pieces.
"These two," he said, and nudged them with his foot.
As they moved, the old man knew they were the ones.
"But they must be cut down," said Rugham, "so they will span the wing only from the outer joint to the tip."
The man measured the wing with a tape measure and trimmed the wooden pieces with a saw. After dabbing ointment onto a folded dressing, he placed it over the wound, applied the wooden splints, and carefully taped them into place.
"Good work," said Rugham. Now strap the wing to the body to stabilize the shoulder joint."
John Versteeg followed his instructions to the letter. A second ointment-covered pad was placed over the shoulder wound, and more tape went around the body.
"This strap will be released," said Ruggum, "after 12 or 14 days to allow the wing gentle movement. The more distal supports will be left in place up to twice that time or longer."
Ruggum was feeling more and more satisfied with their efforts. John Versteeg was pleased also.
"Whoever these little beings are," he thought, "in these matters they know what they're doing."
Nathan was responsible for the injuries because he fired the gun, but the old man had supplied it and was the boy's grandfather. He was pleased to repay the bird and its miniature masters, at least in some measure, for the suffering caused by his family. Loana had been amazingly quiet and cooperative. The old gentleman released his gentle grasp on her, stroked her, then placed her on the floor, satisfied he had done everything he could do. Chelan scurried down the leg of the workbench and strode to Loana, reassuring her that everything would be all right. Looking down from the workbench, Ruggum was in awe of what had been accomplished. A short while ago, he was deeply discouraged about the prospect of the raven even surviving. Yet every procedure appeared to have been performed properly, and now there was a reasonable chance she could heal, and they carry on the mission. Most amazing to Ruggum was that every element of the process came from cooperation between human and Kieran. As far as he knew, he and Jilin had been part of the first such collaboration since the time of their ancient ancestors. Having by no means forgotten that Loana was assaulted, he was stirred by the efforts of her attackers, and his heart was thumping strongly. He signaled for Jilin to come back to the top of the bench, which he did with ease. Ruggum motioned for him to put away the calamar, then whispered to him,
"I am deeply grateful to it. You should tell it. Never mind, I will myself."
He swallowed hard and took a deep breath, then looked at John Versteeg and mustered up his best English.
"Humans and Kirin's friends, long time ago. Would be good, be friends again."
He paused to select the words.
"Maybe this is beginning."
Kieran's The Spell of Noan, written and narrated by James D. Priest.
To learn more about Kieran's, visit www.kieranbooks.com.